KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I'm not sure we should be sending $50 million worth of condoms anywhere. I'm not sure that's something Americans would be really excited about.
Elon Musk joined President Trump in the Oval Office to talk about his work slashing government spending. The underlying message? Trump has his back. For Tuesday, February 11th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, President Trump doubles down on his ambitions to take over Gaza.
We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy.
The King of Jordan was right next to Trump when he said that. We'll have his reaction.
Meanwhile, Trump also says he's taking over the Kennedy Center.
Bob Mondello has a look back at the center's role in American cultural history.
Plus, what scientists learned from a decade of tagging and tracking baby turtles.
The more tags we put out in different areas, we learn new things, and they're surprising us.
Those stories and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump hosted Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House today and used it as an opportunity to both renew his insistence on the U.S. taking over Gaza and Palestinians moving elsewhere in the Middle East. Questioned by a reporter about statements about the U.S. owning Gaza, Trump said the U.S. does not actually have to buy it.
There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it. We're going to hold it. We're going to cherish it. We're going to get it going eventually where a lot of jobs are going to be created for the people in the Middle East. It's going to be for the people in the Middle East, but I think it could be a diamond.
Trump said the U.S. would ensure peace there and carry out large-scale economic development, including building hotels and office buildings. As for accepting refugees from Gaza, Jordan's King Abdullah repeated he opposes the idea. A U.S. teacher who spent more than 3 years in a Russian jail is heading home. The Trump administration says it negotiated a deal with Russia, but has not revealed what the U.S. offered in return. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
We are absolutely in celebration, major relief mode.
This is Anne Fogle, whose brother Mark was arrested in August 2021 on drug charges. He was passed over in previous prisoner swaps with Russia. Their mother, who lives in Pennsylvania, kept raising the case, including directly with President Trump.
My mother spoke to President Trump shortly before he was shot in Butler. He told her then that he would get my brother out, and I give him great credit. He was true to his word.
Trump sent his Middle East envoy to Russia to pick up Fogle and bring him back to his family. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams has been given a reprieve from the Trump administration. That says the Justice Department today moved to drop federal corruption charges against the head of America's biggest city. Adams visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago and has pledged support for the administration's deportation efforts. That prompted speculation some kind of deal might be in the offing. Atlanta-based Coca-Cola says it expects packaging costs to increase with the effects of President Trump's tariffs on aluminum. Marlon Hyde from member station WABE has more.
Earlier this week, President Donald Trump increased a 10% tariff on aluminum imports to 25%. Coca-Cola company officials say if aluminum cans become more expensive, they could pivot to using more plastic bottles. Here's company chairman and CEO James Quincy.
It's a cost. It'll have to be managed. It would be better not to have it relative to the U.S. business, but we are going to manage our way through.
The company reported that net revenues increased 3% to more than $47 billion for last year, and it expects more revenue growth this year. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 123 points. The Nasdaq fell 70 points. This is NPR. Well, then-candidate Donald Trump pledged last year to bring down the cost of food for Americans on day one. That is most definitely not happening in one area, the price of eggs. With the bird flu outbreak continuing to push prices higher, some stores, including Trader Joe's and others, are now limiting the number of eggs people can buy. Trader Joe's, for example, limiting purchases to one carton per customer per day. The Waffle House restaurant chain recently put in place a 50-cent per egg surcharge for customers. Since 2022, the price of eggs in the U.S. have doubled. This week's Billboard charts are out, and for several big stars, the so-called Grammy bump is real. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the story.
The new number one album in the country is Hurry Up Tomorrow by The Weeknd. The Weeknd is one of many artists who rose on this week's Billboard charts following their performances at the Grammy Awards earlier this month. While The Weeknd's album is brand new, older albums by Chappell Roan, Benson Boone, and Doechii also rose dramatically on this week's charts. But maybe the biggest boost of all went to the Grammy's Album of the Year winner. Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter had dropped all the way off the Billboard 200. This week, it re-enters the chart at number 19. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Crude futures prices bumped up to a two-week high amid concerns about Russian and Iranian oil supplies and rising Mideast tensions. Oil gained $1 a barrel to settle at $73.32 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Elon Musk, the billionaire tech executive, has been plowing through federal agencies looking for cuts. And tonight, he defended his work from the Oval Office. President Trump was there, too, to sign an executive order to boost Musk's effort, known as the Department of Government Efficiency. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now from the White House. Hi, Tam.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, so just start us off. Describe the scene for us.
President Trump was seated behind the Resolute desk while Musk and his young son stood next to the president on his right. Trump called the press in for this executive order signing, but in the end, the journalists in the room never saw him sign it. It is signed, though. Okay. Trump started out briefly and then just handed the floor over to Musk, who went on at length about his work, offering anecdotes about alleged government waste and making bold and vague statements.
If the people cannot vote and have their will be decided by their elected representatives in the form of the president and the Senate and the House, then we don't live in a democracy, we live in a bureaucracy.
At times, he talked about minute details like payment categorization codes being missing from Treasury payments. But it isn't clear how he's backing up claims that he has already saved the American public billions of dollars. At one point, he was asked by reporters about claims that the U.S. had given $50 million worth of condoms to Hamas, something that isn't true, but has been amplified by the president recently. And just to paint a picture, at this point, Musk has his son up on his shoulders, and the kid is playing with his hair and putting his fingers in his dad's ears. Musk did admit that some of the things he will say like that were incorrect. But he said that, you know, it really would be an enormous amount of condoms to send anywhere.
True.
Yeah. And then he downplayed the criticism.
But let me ask you this, Tam. I mean, many of Musk's efforts, like the fork in the road email offering federal employees a chance to resign or shutting down USAID, many of those efforts have been put on hold by judges. And there's been a lot of talk, right? Like there's been a lot of social media posts from both Musk and Vice President J.D. Vance that they might not abide by court rulings if they disagree with those rulings. What did President Trump say about that?
He was dismissive of judges who he called activists and said he, the president, was elected by the people to run the country. At this point, his efforts have met with major challenges in the courts. Trump said he will always abide by the courts and will appeal. But appeals take a long time, and he hopes judges will allow the administration to stop fraud if it is happening.
Well, let me also ask you, because Musk and his Doge project have gotten a lot of criticism from good government watchdogs about potential conflicts of interest because many of Musk's businesses have significant contracts with the federal government, and he isn't publicly disclosing all of these potential conflicts of interest. How did Trump and Musk respond to that?
So we should note that DOGE is not an official government agency. Musk said that he checks in regularly to make sure Trump is okay with what he and his team are doing. And Musk insisted he is being extremely transparent, so transparent that everyone could see the conflicts if they were to happen. But I will just cite my colleague Stephen Fowler's reporting here. He says DOGE doesn't have a functional website where they show evidence to back up the claims. They have posted a few online examples on X. But when Stephen looked at a database of government spending, he found that the numbers just aren't adding up.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
Now, if you were expecting interest rates to drop anytime soon, you may have to keep on waiting. Today, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told a Senate committee that he is in no hurry to cut borrowing costs. He pointed to still stubborn inflation and to the strong job market. What else did Powell have to say about the economy and the moves made so far by the new Trump administration? Well, for help answering that question, we're joined now by NPR's Scott Horsley, who followed this tense meeting so we didn't have to. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, the Fed sets short-term interest rates, but Powell was asked more than once today about mortgage rates, right? Like, what did he have to say on that front?
Yeah, mortgage rates are still hovering up close to 7%, which is making home ownership a real challenge for a lot of would-be buyers. It's also discouraging some people who already own homes from moving and giving up their lower-cost mortgages. So it's been a real drag on the housing market. Powell says there's not a whole lot the Fed can do, although once the central bank does lower short-term rates, Powell says that should indirectly help to bring mortgage rates down as well.
I don't know when that'll happen. And even when it does happen, we're still going to have a housing shortage in many places.
Ultimately, the U.S. just needs to build more houses. And, of course, that's going to depend in part on land use policy and labor cost and the cost of building materials.
Exactly. So how would the new administration's policies play into all of that?
President Trump's trade and immigration policies have the potential to raise the cost of building materials and the cost of construction labor. Powell generally sidestepped questions about trade policy today, saying that's for Congress and the White House to work out. He did answer a question from Senator Jack Reed, though, about some of the new president's personnel moves.
Just this weekend, the president removed the board of the Kennedy Center and made himself chairman. What would you do if the president tried to remove a member of the Federal Reserve Board?
Well, it's pretty clearly not allowed under the law.
Right now, there are no vacancies on the Fed board, so Trump's power to reshape the central bank is limited. He will get a chance down the road, though. For example, Powell's own term as Fed chairman ends in just a little over a year.
Okay. Well, in addition to setting interest rates, the Fed also helps regulate banks, right? So how do lawmakers think that's going right now?
Yeah, the Fed got some criticism today from Republicans who complained that bank regulators have discouraged banks from working with certain kinds of businesses, in particular crypto businesses, which were somewhat out of favor in the last administration and are getting a much warmer welcome in Washington today. Senator Tim Scott, who chairs the banking committee, says businesses' access to bank services should not depend on which way the political winds are blowing.
If it's legal in America to do business, we should do our part to make sure that they're banked.
Powell says the Fed is taking a fresh look at its bank supervision manual. Now, most bank regulation is designed to ensure the safety and soundness of the financial system, but there is one bank regulator that it was set up to look out for consumers, and that's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Mm-hmm. It was the brainchild of now Senator Elizabeth Warren after the financial meltdown 15 years ago, and she's furious that the Trump administration has effectively shut the Consumer Bureau down.
No more cop on the beat looking out for your grandma whose bank account has just been taken over by a scammer. No more cop on the beat looking out for people getting ripped off by giant credit card companies that are charging illegal junk fees.
Warren urged Powell not to be an accomplice to that shutdown. And the Fed does have a bit role here because it actually funds the Consumer Bureau. It was set up that way to prevent congressional meddling.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Employees of the country's lead agency for foreign aid got a bit of a reprieve when a judge ordered the Trump administration to reinstate USAID workers who were put on administrative leave. That only lasts this week, though. It did not stop the Trump administration from canceling aid contracts and sealing off headquarters in Washington. And USAID employees around the world are getting mixed signals from the Secretary of State, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
As billionaire Trump advisor Elon Musk took aim at USAID, the president made Secretary Rubio the acting administrator. Now embassies have been reaching out to the secretary to try to keep some USAID personnel and programs in place.
There is chaos, confusion, and trauma.
That's Jeremy Canondike, who used to work at USAID and now heads an advocacy group called Refugees International. He says many embassies are freaking out because they have a legal obligation to manage all U.S. assistance, and they need USAID staff to do that.
They cannot manage their oversight responsibilities if they don't have the USAID personnel there. So there's just total chaos and confusion. You know, this is not being done in a way that attempts to think through or understand the consequences of these actions. The prime directive is just to destroy as much as possible, as quickly as possible.
NPR has seen several cables from embassies requesting that Rubio keep USAID officials on staff, saying without them, the embassies don't have the contracting officers required to run programs or oversee how the money is being spent. An inspector general's report this week goes further, saying there's no one vetting partners in the Middle East to make sure U.S. taxpayer money is not benefiting terrorists. Secretary Rubio, though, has painted all of this as a normal review process.
The goal of our endeavor has always been to identify programs that work and continue them, and to identify programs that are not aligned with our national interest and identify those and address them.
Rubio visited several U.S. embassies in Latin America last week that have large USAID offices, and in public he repeatedly blamed USAID officials in Washington for failing to cooperate with his review. He also insisted that he is issuing waivers for some aid.
Let me repeat it in very simple words. If it saves lives, if it's emergency life-saving aid, food, medicine, whatever, they have a waiver. I don't know how much clearer we can be.
In a court filing this week, though, the State Department's union said contracts are being terminated en masse. One official tells NPR that they had no chance to justify programs that have been canceled. Jeremy Canondike says Elon Musk and Rubio's Director of Foreign Assistance, Peter Morocco, are moving fast before Rubio gets more warnings from embassies, members of Congress, and the courts.
So they're trying to kind of speed run the destruction of the agency, dare the courts and Congress to intervene, and basically gambling that by the time they would do that, the job will already be finished.
A court already issued a restraining order that was supposed to allow USAID employees to continue to work and have access to emails. The union says not everyone has access, and employees who have tried to pick up personal items have been turned away from what they were told are the, quote, former USAID offices in Washington. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sea turtles famously lay their eggs in nests on sandy beaches, and then a couple months later, droves of tiny turtle hatchlings emerge from eggs that look a little bit like ping pong balls, and they scurry to the sea. Well, what happens next in the turtles' lives, the juvenile years, that has been a bit more of a mystery. In fact, scientists call it the lost years. So researchers set out to catch baby turtles in the Gulf of Mexico. They wanted to tag them and learn more about where they go. You can hear the scientists pulling up to a patch of seaweed here. This is right before snagging a baby turtle. Kate Mansfield of the University of Central Florida was there on that boat. She joins us now. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi. So it sounds fun, but also I know it took a long time. Your team spent a decade catching these turtles and tagging them and then releasing them?
We did. It started with the BP oil spill in 2010, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And I happened to be at the right place at the right time working for a federal agency and had just figured out how to tag these little guys when we were asked to try to figure out what was going on with the little baby turtles in the Gulf of Mexico relative to the oil spill.
And how does one go about attaching a tag to these little guys?
It took us a while. We enlisted the help of a manicurist who recommended an acrylic base coat to the turtle shell because it's the same thing as our fingernails, keratin. And that helps seal the shell. And we came up with a couple methods for four different species of turtles that we caught offshore in the Gulf of Mexico.
And just to describe, I was looking at pictures of what your team was doing. It is a mound of, I didn't know it was like nail glue, but a mound on the little guy's back. And then it looks like the size of a 9-volt battery with an antenna sticking up. That's what you're trying to mount on there?
Yes. Yeah. The tags are about the size of my thumb. And we also use silicone or marine epoxy that's flexible. And it allows the turtles to grow a little bit and the tags to stay on for upwards of 3 to 6 months while we can.
Well, because this is another problem, right? That just like our fingernails, their turtle shells are growing and shedding, and so they can just kind of slough the whole thing off.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's a good thing. We can get a little bit of information about where they're going and what they're doing while also not harming the turtle.
So you managed to tag them, you release them. What happened next? What did you learn about where they were going and why?
That's what's really intriguing, because one of the long-held assumptions about this life stage is that they're passive little drifters. And what we found was that these turtles are not passive little drifters all of the time, and they're occurring in shelf waters, in particular in the eastern Gulf of Mexico on the West Florida shelf, where turtles shouldn't necessarily be based on our long-held assumptions.
Okay, so they're not just drifting around with the currents. In some cases, that you're finding they're actually swimming and in places you wouldn't have expected. But why does this matter? I mean, just explain to a non-scientist, why does it matter where our baby turtle goes or whether it's drifting or swimming?
I would say that we know very little about certain times and aspects of a sea turtle life. And if you're trying to protect a species or recover a species, like all of the sea turtles that are in U.S. waters, we want to know everything we can at every single life stage. And if we're missing information during critical foundational periods of their lives, such as the toddler years, then we're not necessarily doing what we can and understanding what we can to best protect them. And, you know, sea turtles are a good way for us to keep tabs on the health of the ocean as well.
Kate Mansfield from the University of Central Florida talking about her study on sea turtles, baby sea turtles. It was published this month by the Royal Society. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Today, Pope Francis released a strongly worded letter on immigration in the U.S. He's taking to task the Trump administration's stance on migrants, calling mass deportations a, quote, major crisis. Joining us now to discuss that letter and what led to it is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Okay, so let's start with the letter itself. What exactly does Francis say in it?
Well, the Pope writes that it's wrong to conflate someone's immigration status with criminality. Francis says that deporting people who fled their homeland because of exploitation and persecution, quote, damages the dignity of those people and places them in vulnerable and defenseless positions. And he specifically refers to a story from the Bible, that Jesus and his parents had to flee to Egypt because King Herod wanted to find this baby and kill him. And he calls Jesus, Mary, and Joseph emigrants in Egypt and refugees there to escape an ungodly king.
And this letter, I know it comes a little after some comments that Vice President J.D. Vance made about immigration and Catholic teaching, right? Can you talk about what he said?
So a few weeks ago, Vance said two things. One, that it was a Christian teaching that people should love their families and neighbors and community before loving people from other countries. And two, Vance said that the U.S. Catholic bishops were only upset about the Trump administration that they had stopped the U.S. refugee resettlement program because they were concerned about their bottom line. That's because the Catholic Church received millions of dollars each year from the federal government to help resettle refugees.
Right. And how did Pope Francis respond to those comments?
Well, very specifically in this letter, the Pope writes, Christian love is not a concentric expansion of interests that little by little extend to other persons and groups. He again turns to a story from the Bible, this time the parable of the Good Samaritan from the Gospel of Luke. Francis writes that by meditating on that story of the neighbor being the one who cares for someone in desperate need, that love builds fraternity open to all without exception. And he calls on all Catholics to refuse to give in to narratives that discriminate and cause unnecessary suffering to migrants and refugees. And then, Elsa, later today, Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, who's Catholic, responded by saying the Pope should stick to the Church and fix that.
Well, Jason, I also understand that this letter comes at the same time, the same day that a number of other religious groups filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration, right? What is the focus of that lawsuit?
Well, more than two dozen religious groups, some entire denominations, are suing the Department of Homeland Security and other officials because the administration has rescinded longstanding guidance that had prevented immigration officers from entering sensitive locations. Those locations include schools and hospitals and also houses of worship. Mm-hmm. The lawsuit says such immigration enforcement actions could interrupt religious services in order to carry out the administration's stated goal of mass deportations. And they say they've seen lower attendance because people fear arrest. And Elsa, among the plaintiffs are the Episcopal Church, the Union for Reformed Judaism, Mennonite Church USA, and the Latino Christian National Network. And the administration, Elsa, has yet to respond to the suit.
A lot of plaintiffs. That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Mars is difficult to get to, but compared to other planets, it seems to be the only plausible place for people to go, and Trump is eager
to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
It would need bipartisan support.
This is not going to work if this is understood to be an Elon Musk hobby horse.
Mars on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump won Arizona in November, but the state also elected a Democrat to be senator.
Coming up, how the immigration debate is playing out there.
It casts a bad name on all of us, even though we've done nothing wrong except for coming here, right?
Now News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says he's in no hurry to cut interest rates.
With our policy stance now significantly less restrictive than it had been, and the economy remaining strong, we do not need to be in a hurry to adjust our policy stance. We know that reducing policy restraint too fast or too much could hinder progress on inflation.
Powell speaking today at a Senate Banking Committee hearing. In addition to the economy, Powell was questioned about the fate of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau under the Trump administration and President Trump's imposition of new import tariffs. Powell said it's not the Fed's job to comment on tariff policy, but to react in a sensible way. President Trump is renewing his proposal that Gaza should be taken over by the U.S. and redeveloped. Trump restated his position during a White House meeting today with Jordan's king. Trump's proposal has been met with widespread opposition from Arab allies, including Jordan. New York City Mayor Eric Adams praising the Justice Department decision to stop his prosecution on bribery and prosecution charges, but critics say the Trump administration is using the DOJ to influence Adams on immigration policy. Here's NPR's Brian Mann.
Adams was indicted last September on charges he took luxury vacations and campaign contributions from foreign agents. Now the DOJ says the case will be halted, though it could be revived in the future. Adams, a Democrat who faces re-election in November, described the decision as a vindication.
And I absolutely never traded my power as an elected official for any personal benefit.
Critics, including opponents in the mayoral race, claim Adams courted Trump administration officials and agreed to partner on Trump's immigration crackdown in exchange for the criminal charges being shelved. In their letter announcing the move, DOJ officials said the decision was not meant to influence New York City immigration policy. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. President Trump has started a second trade war with China, but his close ally and advisor, Elon Musk, is expanding his business there. NPR's Emily Fang reports Musk's company, Tesla, is opening a new battery factory in Shanghai.
In China, Tesla executives applauded how fast the factory making what Tesla calls its megapack batteries went online just 8 months after breaking ground. It's the second factory Tesla has built in Shanghai. Many of its Model 3 and Model Y cars are now manufactured in China, where there is also a big market for Tesla's electric vehicles. Musk's significant business interests in China contrast with a hard-on-China approach President Trump is taking. Trump announced a flat 10% tariff on all goods made in China imported into the U.S. That would include Tesla vehicles. And he also signed a proclamation to reimpose 25% global tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, a measure targeting China. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Russia has released from prison the American school teacher and former diplomat Mark Fogel. The White House says an exchange was negotiated, but it's not clear if the Trump administration agreed to release someone in exchange. Fogel was detained in August 2021 for carrying a small amount of marijuana that his family said was prescribed for him. He was sentenced to a 14-year prison term. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington, with word of a tense meeting in the Oval Office today. President Trump met the King of Jordan for the first time since his inauguration, and also for the first time since Trump shocked the world by saying the U.S. would take over Gaza. Arab leaders have rejected this idea. Today, though, Trump doubled down. He says he wants to move millions of Palestinians out of Gaza so that the land can be redeveloped.
Palestinians, or the people that live now in Gaza, will be living beautifully in another location. They're going to be living safely.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was following the meeting. He is here with me now. Franco, I'm trying to picture this. How did this go over?
Yeah, I mean, let's just paint a picture here. I mean, originally this meeting with King Abdullah was supposed to be behind closed doors. But at the last minute, a small group of reporters were brought into the Oval Office. And this was a very high stakes meeting. Trump floated this idea of taking over Gaza just a week ago. And this was the first meeting with an Arab leader since he did that. The two leaders sat next to each other by the fireplace in the Oval Office, and Trump again insisted that the U.S. would take over the territory, but he would not give specifics on how that would happen.
We're not going to buy anything. We're going to have it, and we're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace.
He was also asked about what authority he would have to do this, and he just said bluntly, U.S. authority. Again, he was unclear about what that means.
Did King Abdullah seem to know what he meant? How did he react?
Yeah, the king kind of laid back. He kind of allowed Trump to speak. He was quiet, perhaps a little uncomfortable. He seemed to fidget at times. And when he spoke, he was definitely more cautious. He at first praised Trump, saying he sees someone who can take the region over the finish line to bring peace and stability. And when he got to specifics, he basically urged everyone to slow down. He said it was important not to get ahead of ourselves. He said Arab leaders plan to be meeting soon in Saudi Arabia to discuss how to work with the U.S. on this, and that they would bring that plan to Trump.
I think the point is how do we make this work in a way that is good for everybody? Right. Obviously, we have to look at the best interests of the United States, of the people in the region, especially to my people of Jordan.
But he also announced that Jordan would take in 2,000 children from Gaza who have cancer or are sick.
Right. Just to fill in some of the context, Trump's plan depends in part on moving Palestinians from Gaza into Jordan, also into Egypt. Yesterday, Trump was saying he might take away U.S. aid to those countries if they don't comply. Did that come up today?
Yeah, President Trump was asked about that. He kind of backed off that threat a bit. You know, he cited the relationship that they have. He noted Jordan's generous plans to take in 2,000 children. But at the same time, Mary Louise, that he was saying that, he was also making sure to reemphasize that the U.S. does provide a lot of aid.
No, I think we'll do something. I don't have to threaten with money. We do. We contribute a lot of money to Jordan and to Egypt, by the way, a lot to both. But I don't have to threaten that. I think we're above that. I do believe we're above that.
Now, frankly, the fact that all this is playing out in front of cameras is very unusual. I mean, it's just another example of Trump's aggressive approach with really little regard for the traditional back and forth of typical diplomacy. And it's putting a lot of pressure on these Arab partners who don't like this idea, yet it's clear they want to find a way to work with Trump.
And just quickly, all of this is playing out with this ceasefire holding, but looking in jeopardy, the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. How does all that factor into Trump's plan for Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, the ceasefire looks very shaky right now. Trump reiterated his deadline for Saturday, and he made clear that, you know, it's unclear what that means, but he did say that he didn't think Hamas would reach the deadline.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Arizona's Ruben Gallego was one of the few Democrats to win a U.S. Senate seat in a state also won by President Trump. As a freshman lawmaker, Gallego now finds himself challenging both Republicans and members of his own party when it comes to immigration. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Ben Giles reports.
Days before Trump's inauguration, more than 200 Arizona Democrats penned a letter to Gallego and other lawmakers criticizing their support for the Laken Riley Act. The law, the first signed by Trump in his second term, directs federal immigration enforcement to detain and deport those without legal status who are charged with theft or certain violent crimes. Many Democrats warned it will eliminate due process for migrants. And some see votes for the measure as a betrayal of the Latino community that helped Gallego to victory in a state Trump won by 6 points. Gallego is having none of it.
They're welcome to give advice to me and everything else like that, but don't come and try to lie to me and say that that's where the Latino voter is, because it's not the case.
Gallego says some immigrants' views on immigration, the border, and border security are more nuanced than what progressives in his own party would have you believe.
They don't feel like they have any connection to this new wave of immigrants that's coming over, even if they are from the same country.
Luis Acosta says that's exactly how his parents feel. The Democratic political consultant, now in his 30s, is protected for now under the DACA program. He traveled to Arizona from Mexico with his parents as a child. His father, a construction worker, and mother, who cleans houses, remain in the country without legal status. Acosta says he understands why immigrants like his parents are frustrated by what they view as the ease with which a new wave of migrants is entering the country.
It's just turned into something that I think got out of control really fast, and a lot of people, including those on the ground who are still undocumented, who've probably been here for 10 plus years, 20 plus years, 30 plus years in some cases, just kind of were caught off guard by.
Acosta says immigrants like his parents and like many Americans are also frustrated by migrants who commit crimes.
It casts a bad name on all of us, even though we've done nothing wrong except for coming here, right? Without permission.
Acosta says his parents understand laws like the Laken Riley Act could affect them because of their legal status if they were ever accused of certain crimes. But Acosta also says they don't envision that ever happening.
From their perspective, it's, well, you know, other than being here illegally, we don't break any crimes, right? We really don't. We just go about our days. We go to the grocery store. We go back home, and that's about it.
Samara Klar is a professor of political science at the University of Arizona. She says while Latinos in Arizona are generally supportive of more permissive immigration laws, a majority are also supportive of some efforts to crack down on immigration.
There is a great deal of concern among Latinos in Arizona about border security and about, you know, weapons coming across the border and drugs coming across the border and even illegal immigration.
Gallego says that's what he heard from voters while running for the Senate. But there are other immigration policies Trump has floated that he won't back.
I did hear on the campaign trail, we want border security. What I did not hear on the campaign trail is I want mass deportations. What I did not hear on the campaign trail was I want to end birthright citizenship.
Representing those Arizona voters' concerns will mean sometimes supporting and sometimes opposing the Trump agenda. For NPR News, I'm Ben Giles in Phoenix.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. NATO has launched a naval mission aimed at protecting its allies' critical undersea cables and pipelines. Nordic and Baltic governments believe this infrastructure is a target of sabotage, likely by Russia. Terry Schultz joined a patrol off the coast of Sweden to see what that protection looks like.
The HMS Karlskrona is on a mission. The potential weapon this Swedish warship is seeking to neutralize is remarkably low-tech. Heavy iron anchors, which have just one simple maneuver, fall off a vessel passing through the Baltic Sea and break the cables and pipelines below. Over the last 16 months, this has happened 4 times, disrupting and damaging vital links between NATO allies at a cost of tens of millions of euros.
The incident was from Latvia, over here
passing north of Gotland.
That's one of the Karlskrona's navigators, Lars, who declines to give his last name for security reasons, pointing out on a monitor where a fiber optic cable with Latvia was hit on January 26th.
Somewhere in this area is where the damage was made to the cable.
In that incident, Sweden seized a ship which had just passed through and was missing its anchor. Finland had set a precedent for this a month earlier by boarding and impounding a tanker whose anchor severed an undersea electricity line. Calling such incidents a grave concern, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has launched a new naval operation, Baltic Sentry, stepping up existing surveillance with more ships like the Karlskrona, adding more airplanes and drones.
We will do everything in our power to make sure that we fight back, that we are able to see what is happening, and then take the next steps to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And our adversaries should know this.
NATO suspects its adversaries are actually behind the incidents. Two of the suspect ships have been Chinese-owned. All of them have been sailing to or from Russia when the damage occurred. At least three of the four are suspected of being part of what's called Moscow's shadow fleet, tankers carrying Russian oil with the aim to evade international sanctions imposed for the war on Ukraine. In all four cases, the ship's operators acknowledge causing the damage, but insist it wasn't on purpose and that crews didn't see anything amiss. Some of those ships dragged their anchors for 100 miles or more. Aboard the Karlskrona, Dutch Admiral Arjen Varnar, commander of one of NATO's maritime groups, is extremely skeptical.
If your anchor falls off, and they weigh about 12 tons, as I understand it,
you're going to notice.
How long would it take you to notice?
2 seconds. If that happens, there's a lot of noise, and you're going to see a difference in the way your ship handles. For me, it's very hard to believe this is an accident.
But while this scenario may be highly improbable, it's apparently not impossible. In that latest incident, Swedish investigators concluded the vessel's anchor had in fact slipped out of faulty locks. It released the ship last week. On this patrol, the Karlskrona didn't see any suspicious behavior from the vessels sharing the waterways. But NATO hopes that simply having more of its crews eyeballing the Baltic like this will make any ship with a potentially loose anchor do more to keep it above board. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz, aboard the HMS Karlskrona in the Baltic Sea.
This is All Things Considered.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Advocates for refugees to the U.S. filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration yesterday in federal court. They're trying to lift the administration's freeze on resettlement services for tens of thousands of legal refugees who were at various stages of coming to the U.S. Some of President Trump's allies have also taken issue with the freeze, especially with how it affects Afghan refugees who worked with the United States. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
One of President Trump's first executive orders, preloaded for Inauguration Day, suspended the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. Another executive order froze foreign aid, which includes help getting refugees resettled when they arrive in America. Melissa Keeney is with the International Refugee Assistance Project, which has filed a lawsuit to resume resettlement and aid.
One of our clients is an Afghan peace activist who was evacuated from Kabul by the United States during the Taliban takeover, and his case, like so many others, is now frozen in the process.
Also on hold is Welcome Corps, a State Department program where Americans sponsor refugees to help them resettle in the U.S. Another plaintiff in the lawsuit, Keeney says, is an American woman who has joined Welcome Corps.
And she befriended a young Afghan woman here in the United States whose family remained in Afghanistan. And she organized her synagogue and community members to raise the money. She now is devastated having made all these plans to welcome this family.
The lawsuit aims to help all refugees worldwide who are stranded by the White House order. But Afghans who had any connection with the U.S. government are in danger under the Taliban, especially if they helped out the U.S. military. And that's where they may also have an advantage, because some Republican supporters of President Trump want him to make an exception for Afghan allies. Here's Texas Republican Congressman Michael McCaul speaking to CBS's Face the Nation.
And I do believe that it was an unintended consequence that needs to be fixed. Look, we promised them we would protect them when they worked with our servicemen and women in Afghanistan. These are the interpreters, the ones who are right alongside our combat veterans.
Especially military veterans have voiced support for bringing Afghan allies to this country, including prominent Republicans like Trump's national security advisor, Mike Waltz. But so far, no exception has been announced, and tens of thousands of Afghan refugees wait anxiously to make their way to the United States. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The arts world was shocked when President Trump claimed last weekend to have the power to remove board members and to declare himself chairman of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts here in Washington, D.C. Trump told reporters he'd do that because the Kennedy Center's shows were, quote, terrible and a disgrace. Then he conceded he had never seen one. All this is without precedent. NPR's Bob Mondello says the history of the National Cultural Center has been marked by cooperation and independence until now.
The very first preview performance at the Kennedy Center in 1971 was attended not by the glittering celebrities who'd be at the opening gala two nights later, but by the general public, and they went nuts over Leonard Bernstein's theater piece, Mass.
I'm so crazy-minded, I keep a kind of enjoying it.
The evening ended with a thunderous 20-minute ovation. Bernstein wept. He was a celebrated weeper. Elsewhere, though, there were sighs of relief, since Dwight Eisenhower first proposed building a new auditorium, singular, to show off American artists in 1955. It had taken four presidents, two Republican and two Democrat, and 16 years to get the center up and running. Former President Eisenhower told the crowd at a 1962 fundraiser, the idea sprang from his learning as he led Allied troops in World War II that America had global respect for its might and industry, but in terms of culture, it was not uncommon
to hear our country spoken of as one of the colonies, and it was in sort of a condescending tone.
The solution, he decided, was to build a cultural center that would put Washington on an even footing with other world capitals.
It would be sort of a artistic mecca that would be open to visitors from every land.
President Kennedy also spoke at the fundraiser, arguing just 1 month after the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis that culture had great practical value in an age of conflict.
The encouragement of art is political in the most profound sense, not as a weapon in the struggle, but as an instrument of understanding, of the futility of struggle.
He noted that even at the height of Cold War tensions, millions of Soviet citizens read Mark Twain and Robert Frost, just as Americans read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky.
Art knows no national boundaries. Genius can speak in any tongue, and the entire world will hear it and listen.
The logistics of letting it listen, though, were complicated. The center was established as a public-private hybrid. The National Park Service is responsible for upkeep of the building. Congress appropriates money for that. But the legislation establishing the center calls for its programming to be sustained through ticket sales and private funding. In short, apart from requiring a broad range of performances, both classical and contemporary, the government would not have a direct say in what played at the center, and from the outset, that independence was tested. Bernstein's mass had a strong anti-establishment, anti-war message, and with fighting raging in Vietnam, that would have made it an uncomfortable sit for then-President Richard Nixon. He was diplomatic, saying he felt the night should really belong to Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and that he would attend the National Symphony's first performance in the new concert hall instead. Subsequent presidents have also been hands-off, except in appointing the center's board of directors, who have historically been evenly balanced between Republicans and Democrats. The actual booking of the center's attractions is handled by staff, who juggle schedules for more than 2,000 performances that play to 2 million patrons every year. The Kennedy Center has hosted dance, music, and theater from all over. Its fourth season included the first joint American appearance of Moscow's Bolshoi Ballet and Bolshoi Opera, and just 3 years later, as if to banish doubts about its commitment to the cultural diplomacy President Kennedy championed, the center hosted a moment fraught with symbolism, since Kennedy had been the president who tried to topple the Castro regime, as Susan Stamberg told NPR audiences in 1978.
U.S.-Cuban cultural relations may have reached an all-time high. Last night, the National Ballet Company of Cuba opened at the Kennedy Center here in Washington, and the nation's dance critics hailed the performance as an historic event.
The center has also co-produced shows that have gone on to great success elsewhere, including the musical Annie. Its just-closed world premiere of a stage version of Apple TV's Schmigadoon may also be headed for Broadway.
She's never heard of corn pudding!
Oh no, it's a song. You started another song!
In short, the center has remained true for more than half a century to its namesake's conception of culture as a democratic ideal.
The mere accumulation of wealth and power is available to the dictator and the Democrat alike. What freedom alone can bring is the liberation of the human mind and spirit, which finds its greatest flowering in the free society.
President Kennedy speaking at that 1962 fundraiser for the center that came to bear his name. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at DignityMemorial.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.